Hi, I'm Gloria. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gloria.
And I'm very grateful and very honored to be asked to speak here in this place this morning. I'm crying at the wrong time. It's not time yet. Nothing sad's going on. I wanted to cry at the play last night. I've been, you know, moved by the hospitality. Of course, as I always am when I come back this way. And I love the people here, and I feel like I know a lot of you more than I really do, and some of you I really do know a lot, and it's good to see you again. Our first encounter with one of you was on the bus that they were taking us to get on some kind of a little propeller airplane. I didn't know why I was on a bus going to the airplane. But fortunately, I heard somebody behind me say, "Here, you take this seat. I believe that time should sit down." I looked at it and thought, "What is this?" And it was Karen from Arizona. So that was sweet at the airport. And so I felt better about flying. it's not easy to make me feel good about flying. And anyway, everybody's been great. Kayla and Susanna picked Bob and I up. And they were both a lot of fun, took us to Walmart, and we had a good time. Anybody that loves Walmart is okay with me. I told her a big night out for Bob and I is to go out to dinner, and then we go to Walmart and walk around. Our life has changed drastically over the years. I have some heroes in this room, in this tent today, and I'm glad to see Dave and Julie here, and I sure enjoyed Leo last night. I have an affinity for tough guys, and I really like that. And anyway, there's just gobs of people here that I love, and I'm glad to be here. I am, as I say, I was just awed last night by the little play. I guess, you know, I mean, it was funny and cute and all of that and very good and all of that. But more than all those things, to me, I was just sort of moved to tears, just knowing the pain behind all the eyes and the stories and the things, the commitment that you brought to showing up. I know there's all kinds of rehearsal and all kinds of trouble and all kinds of hassles it takes to do all that kind of stuff. We do a lot of that stuff where we live, and it's just a hassle. And to just go forward and just keep putting one foot in front of the other always inspires me, so that it gives me what I need to keep putting one foot in front of the other no matter what. And I was just very moved by it. And I'm just awestruck by the power that I feel in this place today. It's wonderful. And I was looking at the program last night and all the people that have come here and shared in this conference, all the people that have had something to do with it. I'm always just awed by the people that go before me. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much, and I'm so grateful for my recovery, for my sobriety. And so I always am especially moved when I'm in a place where there has been a lot of strong sobriety come before me. I'm glad to be here today, glad to be sober. I hate to talk, but I love to be asked. you know, I like to be a part of everything and be included. It's just that when I get here, I think, oh, my God, why did I say yes? But anyway, I'll do the best I can to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. I have my experience, and that's all I can offer you today. And I have lots of hope, and I can offer you that. And I have strength given me through the power that I call God today, given me through the power through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I have some of those things, and I hope that that we all leave this camp this weekend filled up. I know I'm going to. I'm one of those people that believes that I was born an alcoholic, it doesn't matter whether I was born alcoholic, whether I became alcoholic at some point during my drinking, the solution's the same. It's just that I know I was sick a long time before I ever took a drink of alcohol. I was an only child, and I lived in fantasy. I lived in my head. My parents were both alcoholic, and I was just very much into fantasy and very much into myself. That's the way that I dealt with the world. My father died of alcoholism when I was 6 years old. And not long after that, my mother married another alcoholic. And so I knew about what goes on in an alcoholic home. I knew about the violence and all the shameful things and everything. What I didn't know was that the people that lived there were sick. I thought that they were bad. And I thought that I was bad. And I was somehow partly responsible for the things that went on in that house. Everything that happened, I thought that I had some kind of responsibility for it. And I felt ashamed. My feelings... from the time I was a little girl on, were feelings of shame and guilt and fear. I was always afraid, and I was always ashamed, and I was always guilty. Just one of those people that seemed to have been born that way. And I was completely and totally self-obsessed. My sponsor used to say that being self-obsessed doesn't necessarily mean you think well of yourself. It just means you think of yourself all the time. And that's what I did. I was just constantly thinking about how everything revolved around me. And I was ashamed of my mother. I was embarrassed. And I was, you know, I used to think if I could be better, she would do better. She would be, she could be sober if she loved me, if I could make her love me more. And all those little things. I was scared she was going to die and go to hell because she was an alcoholic. And, or I didn't know that word at that point, but she was a drunk. She was a drunkard is the way they referred to it when I was a kid. And I went to this little church school, and I just didn't fit in. And I did what I could do to try to fit in, and it just didn't seem to work. And by the time I was 11 or 12 years old, I made a couple of decisions. I had kind of lost hope that there was ever going to be any kind of good life for me, that I was ever going to fit in. And I just had gotten full of jealousy and hate and resentment, particularly toward the other little girls in my school. And I was tired of trying to be good like them and try to make myself appear to be what I thought they were. You know, my problem was not so much what you thought of me. It was what I thought you thought of me. And because I was always thinking of me, and so I assumed you were. And you know, I just was full of hate, and I didn't want to have anything more to do with them. So I just decided I wasn't going to have anything more to do with them. If I couldn't be good, I was going to be bad. And that's pretty much the way that I lived my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I decided that I was not going to have anything to do with any girls ever again. I was just going to hang out with the boys. And that's pretty much the way that I lived until I came to the program. I had a cousin that went to public school, and like I said, I'm an only child, and I spent a lot, my parents were drunk most of the time, and I spent a lot of time in the movies as a little girl. And my favorite movies seemed to be gangster movies, detective movies, and my favorite characters in the movies were always the bad guys. Just sort of fascinated with gangsters. Always was, still am. I like sober gangsters nowadays, but I just was fascinated with it. And so I had this cousin who went to public school, which made him very exciting to me in the first place, because I was in his church school. And he ran around with a little gang of boys who I considered to be gangsters. They were older than I was. They were about 12, 13. And they all went to this public school, and they all came from homes much like mine, so I wasn't embarrassed to have them come to my house. And they'd hang out over at my house, and they became like kind of like brothers to me, like my friends. And it was good to be around them. I just felt more like I fit in with them. I thought, like I say, I thought they were gangsters because they stole hubcaps and they wore leather jackets. And, you know, back then they called them juvenile delinquents, but, you know, I thought they were gangsters. And so they were exciting and fun to be with. The first time I drank, I was 13. And that's the first time I got drunk. It happened to be Christmas Eve, and I was at this place that I hung out a lot. And some guys came along that I knew, and they weren't my close friends, but I knew them slightly. And I ended up going for a ride with them, and they started drinking, and I started drinking with them. It just seemed perfectly natural. I don't remember making any big decision. This is good, bad, right, or wrong. I just started drinking. They were drinking beer, and I don't know how many I had that night before I began to experience a feeling that was to keep me in bondage for the next 16 years of my life. This feeling was, I don't care. I don't care if I'm bad and crazy and wild like everybody says I am. I don't care if my mother's getting beat up. I don't care if it's Christmas. I just don't care. And the next morning I came to, and I was in an abandoned car, in the back seat of an abandoned car. I was alone, and I was scared, and I was sick, and I was more ashamed than I'd ever been before in my life, and I was an alcoholic. I remember knowing someplace inside me that morning that I had found something that would allow me to be somebody other than who I thought I was. And from that day on, I was willing to pay any price to experience that feeling. And from that day on, all I wanted to do was run the streets and drink and just run wild. I just wanted to get away and run away from what I thought I was. I started to use drugs just about the same time. Drugs and alcohol just went hand in hand for me. It just was where I was at the time, I guess. Anyway, I finally talked my mother out of into letting me out of that church school, and I enrolled in public school. And but I hardly ever went to school much after that. I just started running around with people that were older than I was, and trying, just getting in trouble. And I thought it was great when I'd get in trouble. I mean, it wasn't a problem for me. It was, I was getting some kind of attention, some kind of recognition. And it felt like, you know, I was at least being something or somebody. And by the time I was 15 years old, I was completely out of control. I had been to juvenile hall. I had a probation officer, and I was just out of control. And I didn't go to school, just hardly at all. And I was very rebellious. I hated my stepfather. I hated it coming home and having him there, having him tell me what to do, and I was ashamed of my mother, and I wanted to be free. I always had this feeling of being bound up, of being imprisoned, and so I got this great idea one day about how I could get free. I thought, I'll just get married, and I'll be free. There'll be no one to answer to. Little did I know. I'd been seeing this longshoreman, and he was... it was a lot of fun. You know, he'd take me over to these port cities. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the L.A. area, but Wilmington, San Pedro, we'd drink in all those waterfront bars. I was, you know, I was 14, 15 years old, but I looked older for my age, and the places I was showing up weren't too particular about asking for ID in those days. And so anyway, this is, you know, it was just exciting. I thought, you know, this would be good. And so I married this older man. He was 19, and I was 15. And we were just going to live happily ever after. It was going to be great. We were going to keep on having all this fun. The trouble was, as soon as we got married, he changed. He wanted me to stay home and be Betty Crocker. And he was going to keep going out and having all this fun in all these bars. I started out drinking where I've heard a lot of people in AA say they ended up drinking in all these Skid Row type bars and stuff. When I first got to AA, I heard it referred to as Burma Road, Anaheim Street down there where I used to drink in Wilmington. And anyway, that's the way it had to be for me. I had found a place that where I could kind of be invisible, where what I was didn't show so badly. Everybody was crazy in there, and I just became as obsessed, I think, with bars and that kind of life as I was with alcohol. And I just loved it. I always wanted to be in those places because those were the places that I felt right. And here was this, you know, all of a sudden it was against the rules. I couldn't do that. Couldn't I have any friends over when he wasn't home? I wasn't supposed to go out of the house except to go to the market and blah, blah, blah. And I certainly couldn't drink when I wasn't with him. And so, you know, I found myself 15, 16 years old, scared to death in broad daylight, scared to death to go out to the market, scared to walk down the street. I was afraid that a car would come up on the sidewalk and run over me. I was afraid to be in the apartment by myself in broad daylight, afraid to go from one room to the next. I just knew somebody was hiding behind the door. I knew somebody was under the bed, or something was going to get me. Something was always going to get me. And once I took a drink of alcohol, I wasn't afraid of anything. I ran the streets by myself or with somebody. Didn't matter. I wasn't scared of anything. I didn't care about anything. I had to drink to feel right at all. And so that marriage lasted about 3 years. And toward the end of the marriage, I had a son. And one day I just picked him up and walked out. I didn't give it a thought. I didn't think about anybody else's life. I only knew that I had to go. And I took him and moved back to my mother's house, the place I hated so badly. And by this time, it seemed better to be there than where I'd been. And I was there one night, and I got thinking about one of these boys that were so close to me. We were good friends. I'd known him since I was 11 years old, and I went over to see him. I'd heard he'd just gotten out of a marriage, and I went over to see him. We got started early in Long Beach. anyway, it was Bob. And so he was glad to see me, and I was glad to see him. And it was great. We went out that night. We just had a good time. It was great to be together. Started seeing each other every night after that. And, you know, we both liked doing the same thing, which was absolutely nothing. Neither one of us had any interest in anything except each other and drinking. And so it was good. And we thought, we'll just keep this up. You know, we'll just have fun and we won't have any responsibility. I never wanted to be married again, and he never wanted to be married again, so we thought, this is good. About 5 months after we started seeing each other, we decided to get married. I don't know why. He says he knows why, so he'll probably tell you about that tomorrow. But I was never going to get married, but we decided to get married. So he hawked his fishing pole for money for a marriage license. And that was our financial inventory at the time. It never got any better, believe me, till we got sober. I got an annulment because I'd been married in Mexico that first time. And we started out, we just wanted to party, just wanted to drink, and that's all I wanted to do. You know, sometimes I'd make a stab at. I'd think, okay, now I'm gonna just be a housewife. I'm gonna just do things right, and it just didn't work. And I had my son with me from the first marriage, and pretty soon we had another son, and then we had a daughter. And life got to be a real hell for me and everybody concerned. I didn't know how to take care of myself, let alone take care of three children. And my guilt just grew and grew and grew, and everything just seemed to be just beyond me. I just couldn't handle anything, couldn't take care of anything. So I had to drink. Sobriety became impossible for me. And eventually my oldest son went to live with his father because he didn't want to be with me anymore, and I couldn't blame him. And Bob's and my children, our son and daughter, just went to his mother's house just most of the time. If it was a choice between going to the grocery store or going to the liquor store, guess which was more important to me. And of course I was ashamed of that, but I didn't have, I was helpless. I was helpless. And I didn't know that I was suffering from a disease called alcoholism. I didn't know that I was suffering from a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. I thought I was bad and crazy and wild like everybody always had told me I was. And this is the way we lived for 10 years. 10 years of hospital rooms, emergency rooms, courtrooms, jailhouses, probation officers, social workers. We worked harder at not working than most people work at working. Whatever we had to do, I would con my family for money for the rent and our food, and we'd con landlords. We'd do whatever we had to do. As a last ditch effort, Bob would maybe get a job for a short period of time. You know, I didn't want him to work. I used to cry and beg him to stay home. He tried to work when we first got married, and he'd stay home and be with me because he was my playmate, my drinking partner. And he got kind of used to the idea, and so he never did go to work. So we had to devise a lot of ways to support ourselves. And I was a taker. I just took and took and took. I felt like the world owed me a living. I carried my past around with me all the time, like a big heavy sack. It was my entrance into those bars and into those sleazy places where I'd drank. It was always my deal. If you had lived, I may not have said this out loud, but I knew, you know, if you had the life, the growing up that I had, if you had to go through all those things, poor me, then you would drink too. And I just thought that the world owed me a living. And it didn't make me feel bad at all. What the guilt and the shame that drove me was like something that I couldn't name inside, in addition to the thing with my children. And I was living completely in an opposite way of the way that I'd been taught to live as a little girl. I knew what the good life was. I knew I had standards and morals, and I knew about God, and I had loved God when I was a little girl. And it seemed like the worse I got, the worse God got. Till, you know, I mean, I couldn't even think about God. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just scared to death at the mention of God's name, because I just knew that I deserved the very worst, and I was sure that I was going to get it. Anyway, this is the way I lived for 10 years and after this marriage, and then my husband and I ended up living on Skid Row for a while, and just left. I left my children with my mother-in-law one weekend. It was over 2 years before I went back for my children. I just abandoned my children, didn't go back, and just had to stay drunk. And lived in rescue missions and Salvation Armies and wino hotel rooms, and lived with all the shame and all the humiliation and all the degradation that I hope to ever experience on the streets as an alcoholic woman. I am most grateful today. I never forget when I pull out of my house in a car that belongs to me. Bob tells me it's in his name, but it's my car. I never forget how I sat on those bus benches in Long Beach in dirty, filthy clothes, wondering where I'd been and where I was going. Never. I never forget when I get up in the morning and see where I am in this beautiful place that I live, and flowers all around, and just clean, and the power of God is in that house the way I feel it here today. And our house is clean and full of love and full of Alcoholics Anonymous people. I never forget the way that I used to live. And so therefore, I'm willing to pay any price today. I paid any price I had to pay to experience that sense of oblivion that a drink of alcohol gave me. And today, I'm willing, just that willing and more, to pay any price that I have to pay for my sobriety. I believe that there's a price we pay to get here, and I believe there's a price we pay to stay here. You know, some days it's not easy to just keep putting one foot in front of the other. Anybody who has any time in our program knows this. You know, some days it would be easier to just get in bed and pull the covers over your head, or it would be a lot easier to just go to the doctor and just say, look, I can't, I must be depressed. You need to give me a little something, you know. Or, you know, there's any number of things that I could do and, you know, look halfway legal about it. or I could just go all the way, which is what I would do if I did anything. And I know that. I know that. And so I do whatever I have to do. Whatever's asked of me today in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do it. I try to remain an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to do what I can. They told me, over and over and over, you have to give it away to keep it. And so I do what I can to give it away. And to give it away, I've got to be someplace where people are kind of wanting it, you know. And so it behooves me to be in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I'm not here because I'm, you know, a crusader. I'm here because I need to stay sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the way for me to stay sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me this fabulous life that I could never, ever have imagined before I got here. Eventually, Bob and I came back to town, and we'd naturally been in a lot of trouble, and we were back, and he ended up going to jail. And it turned out he was going to be gone for 6 months. And he'd been gone to jail lots of times before, and every time he went away, I always got in a lot of trouble. I couldn't take care of myself. I was just kind of like a leaf blowing in the wind. Whatever came along, you know, I just sort of blew with it, you know. And certainly I was that way when I drink. Once I take a drink of alcohol, I'm out of control. I am not one of those women who drinks and does the ironing or cleans or does any of those things. I don't even stay in the house. I cannot even stay in the house. I am a runner, and I run, and my idea of a good time is very bizarre. And we'll just leave it at that. And so unlike going to the Walmart on Saturday night nowadays. And I get in a lot of trouble. And this was to be no different. You know, I started drinking. I started running. I ran into some people I'd known a long time before, and they were robbing stores and using heroin. And that's what I started doing with them. Before long, I found myself driving the car for these robberies night after night and never coming out of the house till the sun went down. I couldn't stand for anybody to see me in the daylight. I was so in a pit. I can feel the feeling, the cold feeling of fear. You know, like when you kind of like when you're going to the top on a roller coaster and you're just getting ready for that big dip and that feeling in your stomach. I feel it thinking about how did I get out of there? How could I possibly have walked out of there to where I am today? It's like, how did I escape? But I know the answer to that. I'm not confused about how I got out of there, about the power that brought me from where I was to where I am today. My birthday is January 19th, 1971, and so it's been a long time now, but I still feel, I still can experience that fear of knowing how close I came, you know, what a miracle it is, this Alcoholics Anonymous that has the power to just pick us up, just pick up a little hopeless, helpless alcoholic woman and just move me to where today I can face the world. I can accept life on life's terms. I don't have to run or hide from anybody. And I can accept love, and I can give love, and those things. That didn't even enter my thoughts when I was out there. You know, I may have used the word love, but it didn't have anything to do with patting you on the back or, you know, giving you a cup of coffee or anything, treating you with any respect. I got in a lot of trouble. I got arrested, and they kept me for 3 days, and they didn't have enough evidence to hold me. Nobody could identify me, so they let me out. And this motel room that I'd been staying in was locked up, and I had no place to go. I called an aunt, and she wouldn't have me, and my mother was dead by this time and from the disease of alcoholism. And anybody that would have anything to do with me was in jail at that point. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. And I thought of my first husband. I called him and told him I was in trouble and asked him if I could come over and stay. I needed a place to stay. And he said, yeah, I could come over if I didn't cause any trouble. You know, and I thought, how could he say something like that to me? This is his fault. You know, I always, you know, could work up enough energy to blame somebody else for everything that was going on. And so I went over there, and there was, as usual, all the alcohol that I could possibly drink was there. He always had a lot of booze around, and I started drinking. I just started pouring it down. I didn't drink mixed drinks. It'd been a long time since I had drank mixed drinks. I liked, my favorite deal was just to pick up a bottle of whiskey and pour it down. I was in love with bottles of whiskey. I used to carry the empties around with me. I was so in love with them. And but I'd drink wine or whatever else, beer, whatever you had. I would, you know, what are we drinking? What have you gotten? What are we drinking, they say. And so I started drinking, and I don't know how many days I was there. I don't know much of what went on while I was there. I just know that finally the thing happened to me that happens, I believe, to every alcoholic who's ever given this gift of sobriety, and I believe sobriety is a gift. I believe that it just happened for me. The time came. I had that moment of clarity, and this time came, and then Alcoholics Anonymous was brought to me, and this is how I maintain my sobriety. But I don't think any of us are just bright enough to just wake up one day and just make this conscious decision that we're going to go change our entire life and be star members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think there has to be some some workings there of a power greater than ourselves to get us to where we can do that. I believe that every person sitting in this room today has been touched by the hand of God. I believe we've all been brought here by the hand of God. I don't think this is a human deal at all. I was in this state in that middle place where you can't really get drunk, you can't really turn off the nightmares and the pictures and the remorse and the guilt and the shame and all those things, and you're not sober. And I got real sick while I was there. I came down with hepatitis. I'd had it twice before, and the doctors told me if I ever got it again, I'd die. The first time I ever got it, I was 19 years old, and by this time I'm 29 years old. And I was very sick, and finally he told me that he'd send me up to Harbor General Hospital, which is a county hospital where I live, and he'd send me up there in a taxi cab, and then that would be all he could do for me. So I found myself driving alone in a taxi cab to a county hospital to die. I thought I was going there to die. And I stood in the waiting room of Harbor General Hospital wearing a pair of black Levi's that I'd had on for several months, and I had on a man's shirt. And I weighed about 98 pounds, and I was bright yellow. And my life was over. As far as I knew, it was over. I didn't even have an address to put down on the admitting form. And I got there through no power of my own. I may have got to that hospital, but, I mean, I got to this place, this state of grace that I live in today. Ended up in this hospital. And was in a room there by myself because they isolated you then when you had hepatitis. I don't know if they do that anymore or not. But I was in this room all by myself, and doctors started coming in, examining, and doing things. They did a biopsy on my liver, and the doctor came and told me that if I didn't stop drinking, that I wouldn't live over 3 years if I kept on going the way I was going, and I wouldn't live over 5 even if I never drank or used anything again. And so I laid awake that night thinking about dying, and I always thought that's what I wanted. And turns out, you know, now that I look back on it, it was just another form my self-pity took. And I was laying awake that night, and I was thinking about my grandmother, all the things that she used to tell me happen to people like me when they die. And I was terrified. I just got terrified, afraid to die. And I wanted to live very much that night. More than I'd ever wanted to live before in my life, just simply because I was afraid to die. And I was so terrified and so desperate that I started talking to God that night. And it had been a long time, very long time, since I wanted to have anything to do with God. I didn't want to have anything to do with him that night, but I was just scared. I didn't have any place else to turn. And so I asked him for just one thing, and that was just, please just let me stay alive. I just want to keep breathing. And I had what I believe to have been a spiritual experience that night. I had this awakening. My spirit awoke enough to see a little bit of truth about myself for the first time in my life. And the next morning, the doctor came to my room, and he seemed bright and cheerful and smiley and happy. He said, you're not going to die. He said, we've made a mistake. That shows you how much we know about the human liver. Ha, ha, ha. And I thought, God, I've spent my night reforming, and this guy's made a mistake. Today, I know it wasn't a mistake. I know that God doesn't make mistakes, and I really believe that it was just another little nudge to bring me closer to a place of surrender, so that when the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came my way, I could surrender to it. And that's exactly what happened. Alcoholics Anonymous just walked into my hospital room, sat down, and started talking. Uninvited and unannounced. Sobriety was the farthest thing from my mind. Alcoholics Anonymous sure wasn't in my thoughts. And I stayed in that hospital for a while, and then they moved me to Long Beach to another place called El Cerrito Hospital. And it was there that somebody started coming around telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had seen Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a little girl. My mother used to try to get sober there. That's where she met my stepfather. And she, of course, never was able to maintain sobriety. And so I had seen it. And one time Bob got in some trouble, and we had to go to AA meetings. He had to go to AA meetings. So, of course, I had to go to AA meetings to keep an eye on him. And we went. But, you know, I didn't hear what was going on. It was nothing. It was really nothing for me. Besides that, we were taking Valium and smoking marijuana, but, you know, just to remain a little bit calm while we went to the meeting. And didn't know that sober is sober. nothing. But here's this guy starts coming to my room telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know why he came to my room, and I just kept trying to get rid of him. I thought he was a pest. Turns out he was a patient in that hospital, so he was handy. And he was just trying to give it away to keep it. I guess he was a newcomer. You know how they are. They want to save the world. And he was out to save me. I couldn't get rid of the guy. And finally I agreed to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with him just to shut him up. And he wheeled me down there because they wouldn't let me walk yet. And so we sat around a little table in a little room with maybe 8 or 10 AA members. And they started sharing their experience, strength, and hope that night. And I can't tell you what was said in that room. I didn't know then, don't know now. It's just that I can tell you what it felt like. It felt safe and warm and gentle and loving. And it had been a very, very long time since I'd been any place that felt anything like that. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I continued going back to Alcoholics Anonymous for exactly the same reason I kept going back to alcohol, because I liked the way that it felt. I just liked the way it felt in that little room. And I kept going back to those meetings. And eventually I began to hear things in those meetings, things that were just like, wow. I mean, I couldn't believe it, what I was hearing. Somebody told me that I was not bad, that I was sick, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place where bad people come to get good. It's a place where sick people come to get well. And he told me that I could get well if I would do the things that are outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, can you imagine? I spent my life thinking that I was bad and I was hopeless. There was no, you know, I was never going to live a good life. And here's somebody just telling me, here's this book, and if you do the things that are outlined in this book, you don't have to go back out on the streets and live the way you've been living anymore if you don't want to. I couldn't believe it. I was told that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place for people who want it, not for those who need it. Lots of people need it, but you have to want it to have it. And they said, as a matter of fact, that's all you needed, was just to want it, and you could have it. They made it so simple. It was so very, very simple. It was so beautiful. And I was fortunate to run into people from the very beginning who lived their program by the outline in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I got my sobriety, in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in meetings with people talking about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor had 14 months of sobriety. When I asked her to be my sponsor, I was in a recovery house by that time, and she always maintains that it was me that got her into the big book, because so I was useful right away. Somebody used to talk right here, used to say, you're spiritual. Being spiritual means you're wanted, needed, and loved. And when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're spiritual because you are wanted, needed, and loved. And I like that. So anyway, I was useful right away because I helped my sponsor, God. You know, she had to go to the book to find out the answers to my questions. She always says that, so that's neat. She lives in Indiana nowadays. She taught me a lot of stuff out of that book. And when it came time for me to get out of that hospital, I didn't want to go. I'd been given the gift, and I didn't know it. I had a desire to stay sober, and I didn't want to leave the hospital. I was afraid to leave the hospital because I thought if I go back and live where I've been living, I'm going to get drunk, and I didn't want to do that. And one of the men who was secretary in one of the meetings told me there was a place in Long Beach called the House of Hope, and he said, it's a recovery house for women alcoholics, and he said, I'll take you over there if you want. He said, all they do is you just live there and go to AA meetings and learn how to stay sober, and when you get on your feet, you leave. And I had never heard of such a thing. I didn't know they had anything like that for people like me. And so I agreed to go. I realize now how surrendered I was to agree to go live in a house full of women. You know, the bane of my life, women, females, whatever you had, I didn't have it as far as I was concerned, and I didn't want anything to do with you. And I came to this program hating women, and it didn't take very long at all until I was given another gift on top of sobriety, lots and lots of gifts on top of the gift of sobriety, but this feeling of love for other women. It has spread now. It's, of course, started with women alcoholics, and it has spread now to where I can, you know, I do pretty well in the market. I don't want to hit anybody with my card or anything, any of the other girls in the market. And I'm pretty good everywhere I go. Some days aren't as good as others, but I'm okay. You know, I've developed this love, especially for the woman alcoholic, and I just, you know, it's just something that I didn't ask for. You know, it's just grace. It's just God's grace working in my life. I didn't earn it, and I didn't ask for it. And I've been led to understand that, that's the meaning of grace. Anyway, I agreed to go with this guy to see about living in his house because I didn't have any other choice. And I just thought, well, I'll get there, and they'll give me the interview, and they're going to ask me the questions. I'm going to have the wrong answers, and they're probably not going to let me move in here with these nice girls. You know, probably, you know, maybe they drank too much, but I'm sure, you know, they're not like me. And I got there, and the house mother agreed to see me. She wasn't well that day, but she was saw me in her bedroom, and I sat down. She was in her bed, and I sat across the room from her. And she just said, do you want to come and live with us, honey? And I said, yes. And she said, okay, you can move in tomorrow. Just like that. Nobody asked me how much money I had or where I'd been or where I was going. Nothing. It was just, if I wanted to be there, I was welcome. And that's just a real dramatic example of the love and the acceptance that I've been given in this program ever since. Wherever I go, if I want to be there, if I mean business, like the book says, if I'm serious about sobriety, I'm welcome with open arms. It's a fabulous thing. Anybody new here today, I'm sure you've experienced that, and you're going to continue. You know, just relax. You're going to continue to experience that same open welcomeness within the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as long as you're serious about sobriety. You'll find it wherever you go. The people change, the faces change. My home group, the faces change. You know, just my sponsor told me, just watch the passing parade. You know, they just file by. Now there's our group's going to be 27 years old, and it's like almost hardly any of the same faces there, but it's all the same spirit. It's all the same program, and it's all the same deals. You know, we have all the same things going on, and the solution is always the same. I've always been so grateful since I found out that the black and white, the writing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous does not change. People change. People are fallible. People are human. People move. They die. They get mad. They fall in love, or they have babies, or whatever. We all do all kinds of stuff all the time. People change. We grow. We grow apart. Everybody that's been brought into my life was not brought just to stay there forever. You know, I thought, oh, this is mine. You know, that's what I used to think. It is. You're not mine. You're not mine. The spirit that you bring with you is mine. The gift that you bring me, the gift of whatever growth, whatever experience we have is mine. But then you go on. Some people just go on. Some people stay, but some go on. But the writing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous always just stays the same, and it's just such a safe feeling for me. The program has not changed one bit. The program that's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous has not changed one word since I got sober. The steps are all still just exactly the same, and they work just as well today as they worked the first time that I took a stab at it 28 years ago in some months. I moved into that recovery house, and we had a book study every morning and went to meeting every night, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. I grew and learned things that I didn't know were possible. Got hope. The name of the house was House of Hope, and I was given hope in that house. Hope that I could live a better way of life. Hope that I could stay sober. Hope that maybe I could one day be like those ladies that I saw come into that house to carry the message. They used to come in and have women's meetings in that house, or they used to come and bring us special meetings. And God, I was just fascinated by the look of these women, just the look in their eye and the softness on their face. You know, it was serenity, and I didn't know that. It was God's work, and I didn't know that. But they were so soft and so gentle. And they said they'd been, you know, they talked about being in the places I'd been or feeling the way that I'd felt. And they all said that the solution to all that for them was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as it's outlined in the book. And I got hope that maybe someday I could be like those women. maybe someday I wouldn't have to hang my head in shame or turn away when you looked at me in the eye or turn away, say something smart or run away from you if you asked me something about my children because I was so embarrassed and so ashamed. I got hope that someday I could be like these women. And my husband was still in jail. I wrote him a letter and told him where I was and what I was doing. And he wrote back to me and said that he was going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in jail. And so for both of us to find the program at the same time was, you know, just more than anybody could hope for. We wrote back and forth. And one day I got a nice letter from him. He said, if you look on a certain page in the book, you'll find out what your problem is. He'd been kind enough to research my problem. And the house mother said I could write him and tell him to take his own inventory, so I was most happy to do that. So I didn't know whether we were ever going to be able to live together and stay sober or not. We never had before. We'd try to stay sober little bits at a time, and then we'd, you know, celebrate that we'd been good. And sometimes it was his idea, sometimes it was mine, but, you know, we always agreed. We that was one thing we could always agree on, that we owed it to ourselves. And so we didn't know if we could stay sober together, and turned out it was it had become the most important thing in my life, and I wanted to stay sober with or without him. And if I couldn't stay sober with him, well, then I couldn't be with him, is what I came to. And turns out he came to exactly the same place. And so we thought and were very careful about making plans to be together again. He came home, and we decided, you know, my sponsor, by this time I had my sponsor, and I had already, I had gotten up to the, through the third step to the best of my ability at the time, and found that to be a magic step. Isn't that magic? You just turn it over to God and everything turns out your way. Isn't it good? That's what I thought the first time I did it, because everything, what I was worried about, did turn out to be my way. And I thought, God, this is great. I'm going to do this every day. If, you know, magic doesn't work that way all the time, unfortunately. But today, at least, I am happy and satisfied knowing that it is God's way. And I've come a long ways in these last 28 years toward knowing that things always are the best when they're God's way. My way does not get it most of the time. And so I'm usually very happy to let things be in God's hands. But so I had my sponsor by this time, and she said I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I kept the program of Alcoholics Anonymous number one in my life. You know, I'm talking about the program. I'm not talking about outside things. I'm talking about my program, applying the principles and these steps on a daily basis within myself, keeping in constant contact with a power greater than myself, with my God as I understand him. And as long as I kept that first, she said, it should be fine if we were in love and wanted to be together. So anyway, he came home, and we thought about it, and after a couple of weeks, we decided that we would give it a try. So we got a little apartment in the alley behind the House of Hope. They said, don't get too far away, so I didn't get too far away. And Bob got a job, and he'd go to work every day, and I'd go over to the House of Hope every day, and I thought, if I just keep doing the stuff that I've been doing in this house, maybe I can stay sober. And so one thing led to another. Somebody gave us a little car. He said he was selling it to us for $50, but we didn't have the $50 to give it to him. And so anyway, he said we could pay him when we got it. And we were scared to take this car. I didn't know. You know, I thought they'd been saying don't get too healthy or too wealthy. You'll get thirsty. And I thought, God, we're going to get this car, celebrate, go out and drink in this car. And, you know, why are we getting this car? My sponsor said, God's giving you this car. Because you need it for something, for his business. And it turned out that's exactly what the car was for. I was supposed to go to AA meetings in the car. And they actually let me drive the women in the House of Hope to the AA meetings in my car. And, God, I felt like I was the president of AA. You know, I'd drive up, And I'd go to the thrift store and buy something to wear that night to the meeting. I'd be all fixed up and drive my little car over there and pick these girls up. And, you know, I'd act like I knew more than I did. And if I didn't know the answer, I just, you know, act like I didn't hear them or something. And it was good. It was really good. And life got to be very good. When I was about 8 months sober, my husband said that it was time for us to bring our children home. And my mother-in-law said it was long overdue time to bring our children home. And I thought I wasn't ready. I wasn't. You know, I would tell you I wasn't ready today. I'm never ready for anything. I never think I can do anything that I do. You know, but it's just, it's God does it through me. And I forget sometimes, you know, that the program is going to work in spite of me if I work it. And So anyway, we decided to bring our boy and our daughter and our son home, and we had been living in this little single apartment. We rented a two-bedroom apartment, and somebody was crazy enough to give us credit at a furniture store, and we went down and bought bunk beds for them and sheets. They had a sheet set that went with it, everything. Everybody had flowers on their sheets, and we were clean and happy and sober, and I set out trying to learn to be a mother. In my first year of sobriety, and I think I was 30 years old, and I didn't know anything about anything, nothing. All I knew how to do was run the streets, and the things that I knew how to do were not positive toward anything or anybody, and I just knew that I wasn't going to be able to do this, I wasn't going to be able to handle it, and my sponsor, Miss Positive, always said, you can do it. You can do anything as long as you keep the program of Alcoholics Anonymous number one in your life. And so I learned a little by little by little how to be with my children, how to just be with my children. And I would never, ever try to tell anybody that I was this rocket to stardom or that I learned all these parenting skills. I didn't. I learned pretty much, it's like... why do I try to remember names at the podium? When you said after your father passed away, it was easier to have a good relationship. After my kids left home, it was much easier to be a mother. Believe me. I didn't do a very good job. You know, I'm the first to admit it. But, you know, I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm not the general manager of the universe. I am not responsible for everybody's problems, including my children. I'm responsible for certain things with my children. I contributed to some of their problems, but I am not the creator. My God is the creator, and they have their own life to live. They have their own story to tell, and, you know, I got comfortable with all of that. But there did come a day when I learned how to open up 100% and love my children, 100%, open wide up and just say, let it come, you know, and not be afraid to experience that love. It gives me cold chills when I think about it right now. I can just see it. We were standing. It was Easter vacation. My oldest son came to visit, and... all the kids were there. By this time, Bobby had ran away from home when he was 13, but he was there to visit, and he and they were all there, and they were all around me in the kitchen. I was fixing strawberries or something, and I realized this feeling of peace inside me, this feeling of just peace and just love. I just loved these children, and I mean, I'm, you know, it comes to us when it comes to us. It was long overdue, but there it was, and I was most grateful. And it's been there ever since. I've been able to just do that. I'm not scared to love anybody anymore as a result of that experience. I'm not scared to love. I'm not afraid that you're going to leave me and hurt me, and I don't have to stay rolled up in a little ball. I can just go ahead and love you. You may hurt me. You may leave me, but it's just up to me to love you. And so I can do that today, thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not isolated and alone anymore. I don't have this big, hard wall built up around me anymore. I can just be open for the most part. Sometimes I close up, but for the most part, I can open up. As I say, my children all had their own story to tell, and, you know, life went on. I became very active. I started being active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was brand new, and just have stayed that way. It's just the way I live. I was active out on the streets. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just, I either do it or I don't, and that's the way I am. I, you know, it's not any big badge of honor that I carry because I'm active. I just am. And Bob and I have had our house full of Alcoholics Anonymous things and functions and people, and we've just walked this road together. And another blessing, whoever could expect that two people could live the way we lived on the streets and then come to Alcoholics Anonymous and be so, I was just crazy. You know, he's always, pretty much on a level, even keel. At least he's just quiet, and I'm noisy, and so you don't know if he's not on an even keel. You always know me. But anyway, who would ever have guessed that we could come together in this program and live together in peace and harmony and faithfulness and love and all of those things? I mean, we are in love with each other today. For some of you, you may want to stick your finger down your throat and think, oh, God. But we do love each other, and we would rather be together. I'd rather be with Bob than anybody. I mean, he was my friend before I married him. He's my friend now. But more than that, he's my husband, and I respect him. I respect the way he lives his life. I respect who he is, and he respects me. And there have been many days when he has looked at me without any respect in his eyes, and deservedly so. I've done everything I could to break his heart and to break my marriage vows and vice versa. And because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have to live like that anymore. The past is past. I learned through the practice of the third step and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth that the past is the past. We do what we can do about it through the application of the steps, and then we close the door and walk on. And I'm happy, joyous, and free today. Happy, joyous, and free. In working with others, it says that we're sure that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And that's what I am most days. And, that doesn't mean that life is always just a big ball and everything is just wonderful. You know, we've had a lot of trouble. We've had a lot of problems, lots of pain in our walk, But Norm Malpe used to talk all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd say, in AA, we laugh when we're sad, and we cry when we're happy, and we call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always remember that, I mean, I've come into my home group meeting some nights with my heart just breaking, with my, felt like somebody was peeling my skin off in that meeting or any many other meetings. And, before 2 minutes I'm in there, I'm laughing and carrying on, and some newcomer will say, God, do you just laugh all the time? No, I don't just laugh all the time. And I don't cry all the time. I just, I just live. I just live. And I can accept life on life's terms. And that's what I couldn't do before I got here. I had to drink. I had to put myself out of it to be joyous, to celebrate. I had to drink, put myself out of it to if anything sad was going on. And I don't have to do that anymore. So all three of my children became alcoholics. They all started using drugs and alcohol very early. They all lived on the streets much like I did, and have, a lot of the same story that I have. And I never wanted them to grow up. That wasn't what I thought about when they put them in my arms in the hospital. I did not want them to have to go through that, but they did, And thank God. When they got ready to get sober, Alcoholics Anonymous was here. And all three of our children have told us that they came to Alcoholics Anonymous because of our example. None of them got big educations. We don't have any educations. We don't have a lot of things that a lot of people have. But Alcoholics Anonymous was shining in our home. And my children saw it, and they felt it. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous loved my children like they were family. There isn't much any family. It hadn't been much since we got sober, except our children. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have been my children's family. And they have loved them, and they've cared for them. And they've shared the program with them when it came time for them to come to this program. My oldest son has 13 years of sobriety, and he lives a good life today. I wish he'd fall in love and get married. He already did that once, but, everything doesn't just work just the way I think it ought to work, but, like was said earlier today, I at least have gotten to the place where I can let them have the dignity of their own life. I don't have to just rage and insist that they, why don't you straighten up? I just am grateful he's sober. He's sober, and he's alive and healthy, and that's all I care about, and he's very loving and very gentle and very respectful to me. He's about 6'4", and he weighs about 250 pounds or something. He's a giant. And every once in a while, I mean, I'll feel a tap on my shoulder, and it's David. And there he is in a meeting, sober, and I'm so grateful, because I really thought he was never going to get sober. And Lisa's been in and out of the program. My daughter's been in and out of the program since she was 16 years old. And, you know, her heart has stopped in emergency. She's done all, I mean, you know, there have been, as far as I'm concerned, she's reached her bottom many times, you know. However, it hasn't, I guess, didn't feel that way to her. But right now she's sober, and she's got, she's given us two grandchildren, and they're just adorable. And, of course, you know, I mean, they're brilliant. They're very smart and very cute. And then they love us. They really love us. My little grandson holds Bob's hand. He'll say, I love you, Grandpa. You know, nobody asked him or anything. He just says it. You know, how blessed can you be? I am a Skid Row wino. I live in wino hotel rooms. I go out and do whatever I can to get your money so that I can go take myself to oblivion. I live in dirty, filthy places, and I've got clean, sparkling little grandchildren around telling me that they love me, and children, and AA members, and my husband, and everything. It's just fabulous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fabulous thing. If you're new, please don't go away. Please just stay here, because a day at a time, things are going to just happen for you. Things are going to get better, and you'll be able to live, like the book says, beyond your wildest drunken dreams. I'll just tell you I'll just tell you a little bit about our son. He was 8 years sober, and he died of AIDS. And for the last 2 years of his life, he lived in our house. And I was, one more time, given the gift of you know, this love for my children. This little boy, I didn't even have to, he wouldn't have even had to speak to me, you know. He ran away when he was 13 years old. He had a hard way to go, and because of my drinking, some of it. And he chose to come and live with Bob and I. And so we took care of him, and Bob and I kind of decided that he was going to just go out in style, and he did, you know. He had AA people all around him all the time, and bringing love and food and meetings and one thing and another. And I'd listen to him in there when his voice was so weak he could hardly speak, and he'd be talking to somebody on the telephone, telling him, you know, you need to get to a meeting, and, you know, why don't you go out and have lunch and do something good for yourself, and little things like that. And he was always thinking more about us than he was about himself. He'd always be worried about his dad being tired or something. And, you know, he was just filled up with the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the way that he left us. Last word he ever said was, I love you. And so AA is good, and AA works. I don't care, you know, what anybody says. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best, and the people in it are the best. And, you know, we're human. We're going to all have our ups and downs, but you have given me my life, and I love you for it. When I was new, I used to shop in junk stores a lot, and one day I found a little plaque, and it had some keys painted on it, and it says, the keys to the kingdom. And it reminds me, you know, I don't know what it meant to the person that threw it away, but I've had it hanging in my house ever since I found it. It reminds me of that place in the book that says, now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a hangover and a bottle, I've been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.